Messages Publishing.
This is Cheryl McQuaid. I'm with the Lansing Fisher Body Historical Team. We're preparing to interview Linda Johnson. We're at the Greenhouse. It is November 23rd, 2005, approximately 10:30 a.m. First, we're going to introduce everybody else present.
Doreen Howard.
John Fedewa.
Marilyn Coulter.
And Linda Johnson. What? Could you please state your name and spell your last name for us?
Linda Knight Johnson, J-O-H-N-S-O-N.
And what's your address, Linda?
2249 North Canal Road, Eaton Rapids, Michigan, 48827.
Are you married? Do you have children?
I am not married, and I have two children. I have a son that's 25 and a daughter that's 23.
And
I'm a grandmother.
Could you tell us a little bit about your educational level?
Okay, I graduated from high school in 1968 and went to junior college at Kellogg Community College for a year and a half, and then transferred to Michigan State University's journalism program. And I finished that in 72, and I went to Nashville and worked for the Methodist Publishing House for about a year and a half, came back, got married, went back to school, and got another degree in teaching speech and English. And I graduated from that program in 76.
And did you do any military service?
No, I did not.
Okay, Linda, I'd like you to think about the day you hired into Fisher Body. Why did you hire in, and what day did you hire in?
My husband, Larry Johnson, had said they were hiring, and at the time I was waiting tables and working in our own, we had a family business, and I was doing that, and I was clerking in a grocery store, so I was making not a lot of money, and I was working three different jobs, and there weren't teaching jobs back in the late 70s, because I don't know why, but there just weren't a lot of opportunities in the teaching field. So he kind of just gave me the dare, and I came down and put in my application, and I got hired. And I came in the summer. It was like late June of 78, and I just remember all the noise and all the people and all the buzz. It was just a big, big facility. Other than that, I don't remember if it was clean or dirty or anything about that. And that everybody was just very nice, trying to help you feel comfortable.
And what job, what shift did you hire into?
I worked on nights, and I worked in hard trim on the big car line. And I worked, I put on BX moldings, BMX moldings, that's what it was, on the bottom of the big car doors, plus a lot of other smaller items inside the car door.
And how long did you do that job?
Oh, golly. I don't know, maybe we did it for a couple of weeks, and then we had changeover. And then I probably did it for another year and a half, 2 years. Yeah. And then I got shipped to the line downstairs where they built the cutlass because someone wanted my job. An injured person thought my job she could handle, so she took my job, and I was kicked down to the cutlass line and started putting on windshield moldings or backlight moldings, the trim around the window.
Oh, okay.
And I did that until about 1982.
And were you still on the second shift?
Yes.
Do you remember when you first hired in, any pranks that were played on you?
No, everybody was pretty nice to us. Yeah. I don't recall any pranks. I know that I think part of it's because I wasn't as young as some of the others, so maybe that kept me out of the hot seat. But I saw my teammates get shipped in the trunk to go down the line and that kind of stuff. But it was just things to pass the time.
So you went to the small car line for another year and a half. Where did you go after that?
After that, they were looking for some. At that time, we were having a competition with another plant on employee involvement and quality, and They were looking for someone to help with the newsletter. At that time, Larry Cummins and another young man were doing it, but they had had problems and they needed another person. So I said, well, I was a journalism graduate, and they wanted me to show my stuff, so I put a couple of night shift newsletters out, and then they said, okay, they'd take me. So I started working on the Line Time, or it was called Comments back then, and it had been a salaried newsletter done through the Labor Relations Department, so they let us do it and took it out of their hands.
And that was about what year did you start that?
Late 82. Late, yeah.
Do you remember much about the supervisors that you had?
Yes.
Did you have a favorite or a not-so-favorite?
Well, on the line, the supervisors were okay. I was there to do my job, and they were always good to me, you know. I mean, as supervisors can be, they give you your check on Friday or Thursday night and say thanks for coming in every day. So, Doreen?
You said you came in sometime in June of 78. What was the environment like in the trim area at that time?
Most everybody that was around me were young people. And it was noisy, and stock was all over the place. It's not neat like it is nowadays. I can remember climbing over both sides of the line looking for the stock that I needed to install. I put in these door bumpers where you'd shut the door and it'd just be a nice item, trim piece for it to hit. And we would fight to find the right size because it was all junky.
Marilyn Coulter.
I want to go back to when you started with the newspaper. And that was when employees first started getting active in management type of activities. How were you received by both the salary and the hourly people when you started that job?
It was pretty funny. I had a journalism degree, and Betty White, who was the personnel director, would call me Larry's helper. And Larry, God rest his soul, he's a great guy. He had a big heart. He could lay out anything. I mean, you know, a newsletter. He had a great eye for pictures. But I did all the writing. And she'd say, I was Larry's helper. I said to the boss, who I can't remember, who was editing us then, maybe it was John Angelakis, I said, when do I get to become an official person on this paper? I've been doing this for over 6 months, and I'm still Larry's helper. But out of the plant on legal problems, the other person that had been the editor, they were just kind of holding the job for him, that he was going to come back. Well, that poor guy is never going to come back, you know, he's in the hoosegow. So they finally said it was my job. So, yeah, to Betty White, I was just Larry's helper.
So, when you got that job, when you went through the plan and your coworkers saw you, did they treat you any differently? Did they?
I thought they were. If anybody had a problem with me, I don't know about it. Mm-hmm. I like them. And
so. So from 1982 to present day, you've just been the editor in the newspaper?
Right.
Can you tell us what types of things were your responsibility as an editor? What types of things?
When I started out, we had a graphics department, and we had, of three graphic artists, we had two photographers, two plant photographers, and Larry and myself worked on the newsletter. Well, as people would move on, Larry moved on to a safety job. Okay, then I had the newsletter, but I still had the help if I needed help from the photographers, and then I had the help of the graphic artist people. Well, then the photographers went away. They went on to the media center, and all of a sudden I had no photographers, so I had to take my own pictures, which was fine. I could do that. But then I had to step up to the 80s and the 90s, and that means you had a desktop, a newsletter. So got rid of all our graphic artists, and we used to have three fabulous artists that would just do all the, if you wanted a sign or anything for a meeting or big shots were coming to the plant, our plant could make the best banners, and they'd have them up there. And our plant was so special for that nobody realizes what great people we had in our plant to do those things. So now I have to lay out my newsletter, so I had to go back to school and get some training in desktop because I didn't have a graphics person to help me lay it out anymore. I had to take my own pictures. So here you go from a whole lot of people working on, helping on a project, down to one person. So that really was a struggle for a while, but, you know, I got there.
So did General Motors send you to school for this, or did you?
No, I just saw the handwriting on the wall. I knew I had to do it. So. And there were plenty of people in the education and training group to help me along, too.
So
coached me.
What would you say were probably some of your most memorable stories?
Well, there's lots. A lot of fun, and that was a great thing about my job. I got to meet lots of people from all walks of life, from, you know, the big shots that came through the plant, like Mr. Smith and Mr. Hoagland and some of those guys, plus our great UAW leadership, Bieber. I have a picture of me and Owen Bieber, and you don't know how big that guy was until you're standing next to him and you're looking at his, you know, the buttons on his shirt. So, anyway. I was, at one Christmas time, back in about 90, I want to say it was about 93, Jim Zubkus was our plant manager. Somebody had asked me to come up and paint and shoot a picture. And it was because the group in paint had collected a lot of money through their coffee fund over the year, and they had done something nice for a family. So their boss wanted me to take their picture. I got up there with my flash camera outside the booths, and I was taking their picture. One picture was fine, two was okay, but the third one was a curse. The turbo bells dumped, and that's where all this solution comes down, because the booth thinks they're having a fire, so all this stuff comes down, and it shut down half the plant. And when I saw it coming down, I knew I was in trouble, and I turned around to walk the other way, and I saw Randy Thayer, who was the assistant plant manager at the time, walking. And I thought, I got to hurry out of here, because this was the day of our Christmas party, my work group's year-end meeting and Christmas party. So I booked. I packed up my camera. I got out of there, and I saw my boss later in the afternoon. I said, I'm in trouble. He said, what happened? He said, okay. Well, came to work the next day, and everybody was laughing. They told me I was job security for them. And that... And I saw Jim Zubkus later on. I was crying, and he's chasing. I'm trying not to cry, but he's chasing me around the accounting office telling me, don't cry, don't cry. He said, yeah, Randy was going to fire you, but I talked him out of it. So he said, we know you didn't know, and I didn't, but I had always felt that the paint supervisor had set me up. I just felt that way, and I can't remember his name, and that's, we don't need it for this, but... So I figured that I cost him about $300,000, shutting him down like that.
Cheryl McQuaid. Linda, do you remember how the place is a huge place? Mm. How did you get around to do all this?
Well, I had to get a driver's license so I could drive a scooter, which was great. We used to have one-person scooter you could drive around. But then there was an accident, and Mr. Zubkus removed all scooters. So then you'd have to borrow a truck, and oftentimes I'd go down to where my husband had worked in tooling, and those guys would loan me one of their trucks, and I could deliver my newsletter that way, and I'd drive it all over the plant. On one occasion, my truck that they had given me wouldn't stop, and it was between shifts, and I was back in the where they build the quarters, and they were metal porters, and they were all hanging up, and it's like an iron curtain that, just think of those windows with the levers, and I was going on this cart, and it wouldn't stop, and we went right through that curtain of quarter panels, and I had my arm up over my face, and I cut my arm pretty bad, and the scooter hit a locker and stopped, and some of the skilled trades guys that were working came back to get me and picked me up, and I was bleeding, so they wrapped me up. I had my arm up over my head, and they took me over to medical, and I went into medical, and the nurse in there, looks at me, and the blood's just rolling down my arm, and I'm, you know, I was laughing with the guys, and she looks at me, and she said, "Have you got AIDS?" And I said, "No, I don't have AIDS." And so she patched me up. But I thought that so telling about our era, though, you know, it just, you wouldn't have thought of that. It didn't even cross my mind, but, you know, it was in the news, that kind of stuff, so. And I don't even know that there was a lot of plans yet for that, how to act if something, but that was on the top of her mind. No, I don't have it.
So,
Doreen Howard.
During your time of working on the newsletter, do you have a favorite story that you worked on or anything that just sticks in your mind as being...
I don't think I have a favorite
story.
But I always enjoyed the happy stories of the families and the plan. So, you know, when I first started, we had the two families in the plant that adopted Asian children. That was fun. I mean, it was a nice story. And then later, when we had Vietnamese people come into the plant, I wrote a 4th of July story about their struggles to get here. There was about 3 or 4 families that I interviewed. Larry Cummins worked with me on that. He took some great pictures. Anyways, we did that, and that was... I even had taken a graduate class and written that article for my graduate class, too. Anyway, that was a cool story, though, how they had survived.
Marilyn Coulter.
My question to you is, how did you get your story? I mean, how did you find out about where you wanted to write about?
People will tell you, you know, I got this cool guy, you know, he just shot a bear, or, you know, these folks are adopting new kids, or... Hey, did you hear about this guy? He just discovered his daughter after 23 years, you know. People tell you those kinds of things. Then you go out and ask them if they want to share their stories.
So were people usually readily available and willing to share their stories?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did. So besides the neat stories about families and... I would get calls from the QCAs, but EPG leaders at the time. They wanted to have a graduation issue. Some of the newsletters on the 652 side had a graduation issue. Would I try it? And I said, oh, no, that'd be awful. So much work. How many kids? Okay, I'll do it. So the first year wasn't too bad. It was about 1984. About 1987, that was the first one. And maybe I might have had 30 kids. Well, it caught on real quick once people realized what you were going to do. And I'd have as many as 130 kids. Nobody else in GM around here that put out a graduation issue had that many kids. And we'd put in their picture and write a story about them. And even though I didn't want to do it, it was one of the best things I ever did for getting... accolades for, you know, people say, oh, thank you, because everybody wanted you to say something nice about their kid, which, how hard is that? You know, it's wonderful. Everybody has a lovely family, and sometimes it's earlier or later, but sooner or later the kid comes through for them. So.
Cheryl McCoy. Linda, could you tell us a little bit about your bosses while on that position?
Okay. My first boss was Johnny Angelakis, and he was just like a school teacher. He'd graduated from MSU's journalism school also, and he had written the Fisher Body paper back in the 60s for about a year and a half. He had done that while he was in labor relations. So he edited me like a school teacher, and I'll tell you, he really helped me become a better writer. As much as I didn't, you know, some people don't like to be corrected. They don't want you to put a circle next to something and ask a question. They want you to say that what they've done is good, because I've hurt people's feelings by telling them they needed to switch something around. There's a way to do that. But I never was troubled when he would correct me, because he made me look better. And that's what you want to do, is always try to strive to do better. So he made me a better person, or a better writer. And then I think I got traded off to some other people. Rent-a-supervisors were brought in, and because John was really busy with his safety job. That was really hard, a lot of work. And later, Bob McMonagle was, but he didn't care what you did as long as you didn't break the rules. And then later, John Rosendahl was my boss, and he was a pretty good critic. He's pretty aware of people, and he might not say it exactly right, but he has a good theme for how people understand things. So I learned a lot from him, too.
So you said that Bob McMonagle wasn't so bad, but, you know, just as long as you did the job and you didn't break the rules. What were some of the rules? What were some of the restrictions on you?
Oh, well, you know, you can't... Well, you don't debate safety. I learned that. I didn't learn the hard way. My counterpart learned the hard way. You do not debate safety. It is what it is. And you don't put pet management against management or union against union. So,
Michael Fleming.
You talk about the McGonagall and his MSU days.
Angelakis.
Okay, it was Angelakis. Can you talk about some of the training and education that you went through to stay within your position, and or what types of, did you have any training?
From after?
Just as you made this journey through journalism, the types of training and what was available to you and what you did to stay on top of your writing.
Okay, at Michigan State, they have a great, one of the best journalism schools. And they just have a regular program for, you get a year of photography, you do the writing. I worked for the Clinton County News, you know, that was my job. I'd go to their DeWitt Township meetings and, you know, then I'd write about it and give it to the Clinton County News for their weekly paper. That's what I did in college. Or you'd write for the state news. Then after college, I went to the Methodist Publishing House and I reviewed books and wrote book jackets.
Marilyn Coulter.
Linda, prior to you getting the editor's job with General Motors UAW, you were on the line. How did it make you feel after you went through two different programs? You have two BA degrees in, you know, journalism and in speech and language, and then you come in and you work on the line. How did you feel about that after you went to school for that?
I never felt bad. You know, it was nice to be in there. I liked to read. So it gave me an opportunity that where I worked, I did my job, and I could read a book. It really slowed me down because you'd read a couple of sentences and you'd do your job, you'd come back. So it made me a slower reader where I used to be a fast reader. Mm-hmm. And I'd read a couple of books every week and I'd read three newspapers every day. I loved I really liked working on the line, except, you know, you're up until 2 o'clock in the morning and you're tired and... It's all right.
As an editor, what types of hours did you have if you were the only? I mean, all your staff got taken away from you. So, what kind of hours did the editor have?
It was,
you had both shifts.
Oh well, that's what was cool. You know, I was a young mom, and John Angelakis said, "Well, come in a couple of days a week and work split it. Work midnight or noon to 9 or something, so you see the night shift." I would do that. I did that for a few years. And then I thought, well, I'll just come in whenever they need me. So I'll work what suits me and my family. So I did, it really worked out well. I'd bring my kids into the plant. I'd put them in my office to work. They could do their schoolwork. And I'd go out on the floor. I could do a story. I could take pictures. I could do any of that kind of stuff. And it was neat to have my kids. They could see what their mom did for a living, you know.
Well, now, how often did you put a paper out? Did it come out weekly, biweekly? You know?
When Larry and I were working together that first few years, we did one a week. We did a four-page newsletter once a week. And then when Zubkus came in, we became Lansing Car Assembly, which involved the chassis side and us. They were trying to make us a team. So then Mike would put one out Mike and Pauline Oliver would put out a newsletter for 2 weeks, and then I one for 2 weeks, and then I'd put out one for 2 weeks. You know, it's we'd slip back and forth like that. So, and then we got another plant manager, and she wanted her own newsletter. So then we had body plant newsletter, a chassis newsletter, and a combined newsletter. So it was just a, you're always trying to make somebody happy. So then I put out two a month. So
now, did you covered implant programs? Did you also cover UAW programs?
Oh, yeah. Those were the most fun because there was a lot of activities going on at the Union Hall. They had their Black History program and their Hispanic program and Christmas programs and picnics and stuff. So that's about the only place you could really get the people element anymore was those kinds of things. So, yeah, I tried to hit as many of those as I could.
So, was there anything that made your job particularly difficult?
No, I don't think. It's just there was always something, and it's like any job, you know. One week they want you to pay your bills, the next week they want somebody else to pay your bills, and just keeping on track of all that stuff. And when I came up to work in John Rosendahl's group, all of a sudden I wasn't responsible for everybody's bills because there wasn't a clerk around, so I had to take care of my bills plus training bills. It was just more paperwork.
Because you work so closely with management, did you ever get the feeling that your other hourly counterparts felt that you were more management than hourly?
Oh, they might have thought that. I don't know. They may have thought that, but I'm not. I'm a member of the UAW.
What is it about being a member of the UAW that you like?
I like being a part of something that's connected, something that's big. It's not about me. It's about a whole group of people. Where I think in management, it's about themselves, bettering themselves. And, you know, not that that's bad. It's just they don't have the network that we do, I don't think.
Was there any reason that, since you did have all of that college background behind you, that you never chose to go to management?
I never considered it.
Cheryl McQuaid, you worked with John Rosendahl, and we know that John Rosendahl's kind of the, I'm going to say party planner, but that wasn't his official title. Did you get involved in any of the big celebrations?
Oh, yeah. We'd have meetings. We'd sit down in the morning with our coffee, and we'd start talking about, like, well, you know, Zub wants to have a big blowout for the best launch ever. And so then we'd start flipping ideas back and forth, and that's how a lot of that stuff would start. We'd just start. It might just be me and John, or it'd be Mike and John and myself, or it might be, you know, just four or five people sitting around tossing ideas around, and then everybody'd be given an assignment, and we'd go for it. So, yeah, John, he's got a lot of great ideas and a lot of good connections.
Can you tell us what the best launch ever was?
The best launch ever was congratulations from Hoagland and the gang. Wanted to congratulate the people on what a great job of kicking off the car that we had done. So we went to, John and I went to this place that blows things up to visit with them about, you know, we talked about getting the Wharton Center, we talked about getting, or not the Wharton Center, the Breslin Center, and we talked about other big places in town where you could get everybody there. And it was just a lot of, I had to write letters to people all over town, you know, and I had to invite all the bigwigs to come. It was just a lot of work for 4 hours of whoopee, you know. And it was the best launch ever party we ever had.
Michael Fleming.
Mike Fleming. While you're talking about that, you want to talk a little bit about some of the other things that you did in there, and specifically, I'll point to when we had Bring Your Child to Work Day, the types of things you did on that particular day, and we also had a appreciation for team members that garnered pizza for those folks and what you did there. Mm-hmm. Could you talk about those two?
Oh, yeah. The team awards, or when they would award the teams for team spirit or completing a project or problem solving or any of those things, they'd have a pizza party for the people that have, say, they've had 6 weeks of whatever error they corrected, and they've had 6 weeks of no more errors or no more discrepancies. So they'd give them a pizza party, and a lot of times they'd invite me to come in and take their picture, and then later I'd bring it back down to their area, and they'd post it with their award that they'd gotten from management for what they'd done. And every year we'd also have Bring Your Child to Work Day. That was usually around the April 21st time frame. And some years it was really big, and some years it was just pretty straight because we were really busy building cars. But one of my favorite years, we had a lot of people up in the old salary dining room. We had women there showing women's trades and the women's work in the auto industry, and the suggestion department would be there, and just all these different careers available to young people, and they could just have a little tour of that as well as the plant. So I'd just go around, take pictures, and it was fun because everybody would be there with their families.
So Linda, what kind of office parties did you have? Did you have anything special for Christmas, Thanksgiving?
I'll tell you, when I got taken into John's group, John Rosendahl's group, that's a best group at recognizing people's high points in their life. If it was your birthday, John made sure you had a birthday card just from him, and there'd be some celebration with the group. Well, our immediate work group, John might have had maybe 25 people under him that was on his pay screen. So you'd always have at least 15 to 20 people there to wish you a happy birthday. Or you might go out for lunch for your birthday, but usually it was cake or donuts or some kind of treat. Never the same thing. But and then if you were having your anniversary, your 25th anniversary with a company, or your 20th, he would have everybody in for that and have your picture taken with him, you know, getting your award. And at Christmas time, we'd have our year-end meeting every year at 2 o'clock. And it would be at a local restaurant he and I had picked out, and we'd have a menu we'd already fixed, and we'd go, we'd play pool, whatever the venue was, and play pool or do something, the whole group together, and he would bring a game, and we'd play for little gifts that he had gotten everybody. Plus, he would always have a gift just for you, too. So, I don't know, he just made coming to work fun in a lot of ways that nobody else had ever taken that much time to do.
So. Being in the office environment, what kind of parties did the other groups have?
Well, in the plant, on holidays and special occasions, they'd have dinners at their picnic tables where everybody brought a dish to pass, or they would order food in and everybody'd contribute and they'd have a party. And sometimes they'd ask me to come down to those, and this is going to sound awful, and I would always have so much fun, you know, especially on the holidays when they're all having their big parties. And I found that the kindest people were the people that worked in the body shop, because they'd invite me out to their parties, and they'd say, sit down, Linda, have something to eat before you take those pictures. But people in paint never asked me to sit down and have food with them, and trim people, sometimes they would. So after a while, you know, you're coming around, you're shooting pictures at all these parties, and you look at something, looks pretty good. I quit asking, I just started taking. So I think that's what I'm supposed to do anyway.
Doreen Howard.
Early on, you talked about your education. Did you ever use any of the bargain benefits from General Motors to further your education?
Yeah, I used TAP when I knew I had to join the next generation and know how to use a computer because I was such a typewriter girl. And I went into that kicking and screaming, but that was probably what saved me, was learning how to use that computer. And I learned the desktop publishing, and it was a lot of fun once I had got over my fear of pushing the keys on a computer. And I'd also taken a writing class, a graduate writing class in magazine writing, and I used my TAP for that.
Was keeping up to date and furthering your education something that was expected of you in your position, or was that just for your personal enhancement?
Oh, well, the computer part definitely was expected. Because I'd have gone away if I had hopped to it. And my counterpart on the other side, he would not take a class. He got into it a little bit, but I'd have to talk him through things. Because he'd bring his file, I would help him with his graduation issue, and he'd bring all his stuff over in one continuous file. And if you're looking for 75 kids' names and their stories off one continuous file, I can't tell you how hard that is. But it is difficult. Marilyn?
Did your job ever allow you to travel or go to off-sites or anything?
Not as much as my counterparts at 652 got to go to all these special events up at Black Lake and stuff, and they'd always say, well, how come you're not going? And I'd say, well, nobody told me about it. And they said, well, you should tell your union hall. And I said, one of the girls said, and I said, well, if they wanted me to go, they'd let me know. So I didn't go on those kinds of offsites, but I did get to go to Saturn a couple of times when they were the king of the world there for about 10 years ago. We went down there a couple of times to special events, which was fun. Interesting, too. Got to meet Gary Cowger down there. And saw their beautiful Union Hall.
Michael Fleming.
When you talk about Saturn back then, when they were thriving, really going strong, what do you think about that? Their manufacturing process that you could see then applied to the one that we used here, and specifically going into where we're going now, what do you think about those three manufacturing processes?
Okay, when I was there, it was really cool, their train ride, and I think about our tours at our plant. When you toured our plant, you really saw stuff. When you toured their plant, you didn't see anything. They gave you a great demonstration of their wonderful doors. You know, they'd ride over them with a little train you're on, and the doors weren't dented or broken or scratched or anything. They still look great. And I mean, that was impressive. That made you want to go buy a Saturn. But then they'd tour you around the plant. You couldn't see anything because all the stock's in the way. But they'd tell you what was going on. And every now and then you might see a person, but you didn't see anything like you can see in our plant when you're riding around on the train there. You can really see stuff going on.
You can see the process here and cook that.
But what they showed there that I saw hope for us is they had these great team rooms where people could go in and, you know, check, log onto their computers. You know, they could do a lot of things that I don't think our team rooms ever got to, you know. They had TVs in there and they had picnic tables, and that was it. Where at Saturn, they had places where people could really kind of connect with each other, or so maybe in the next facility we'll be. So I think that's what Saturn had that we didn't have.
Marilyn Coulter.
Linda, you've covered, like you say, you covered union, you covered the line, you covered the management things. Lansing has always been called the capital of quality. What do you attribute that to?
I think it's the people's work ethic. I think everybody that comes to work at our plant wants to do a good job, and their frustration is when the materials or something is thrown into the mix that isn't up to snuff, and that gets frustrating. So then you get an angry person that says, rats, you know. So when you have that many people and we're running, you know, we're more than one plant. Most plants are just one system. You know, we had two systems. We had a lot going on in our plant that nobody else ever did. And it's a wonderful group of people that can put that all together and still ship them out every day.
Do you feel that once the like back in 82 when they started getting a lot of employees involved, that helped raise the benchmark for us?
Oh yeah. I think people saw possibilities that their voice would be heard. They weren't just a number to build that car and ship it out the door. So they saw hope. And some of it really worked for them, and it's just a fountain you got to keep feeding.
So being an editor and a person with 2 degrees, and from interviewing people on the line, did you find many people in the plant like yourself that have had a lot of educational background?
Yeah, I was surprised. There was a lawyer that worked in there, and there was a woman I interviewed that worked on the night shift. I think she took care of her family, too. And she's, like, really smart, like Mark Strolley smart. And I hope that child went on to some bigger and better things, because she was wasted where she was. I can't remember her name. I did a story about her, too. That's all. Anyways, yeah, there's a lot of smart people in our plant.
So actually, oftentimes...
And not just education-wise, but I mean just smart.
So there's a lot of people who had a misunderstanding of what they thought factory workers were.
Right.
Linda, I really appreciate this time that you've given us. And I'd like to say thank you.
Well, you're welcome. It's been fun.
Thank you.
Thank you, Linda.